In Tynwald this week, there were questions on the impact of the Iran war, an urgent question on bed spaces at Nobles, and the ongoing work at the White Hoe. We'll hear later about debates on the post office, scrutiny of government's response to Tynwald decisions, and the horse trams. But first, I spoke to Tim Glover.
You and your colleague had urgent questions to the Chief Minister, or starred questions, I should say, to the Chief Minister in relation to the Isle of Man's preparation, or Isle of Man government's preparation or response to the war in Iran. So what did you think of the responses the Chief Minister gave?
I was largely encouraged by what he said. It was what you'd expect him to be saying at this time. We'd obviously had the stories in the media and everything. I just felt we needed to have something said in Tynwald, and that's why I put the question down.
UK government has admittedly released a somewhat uncertain bit of money, but as in uncertain as to who's going to benefit from it. But there has been some move, at least in the UK, to give reassurance to vulnerable people, people who have little access to additional funds to pay for their oil bills, which, you know, heating oil bills will have gone quite considerably higher now as a result of this conflict.
Yes, I think we're in a relatively good position. We heard about the buying that Manx Utilities have done, and they have a pretty full order book so far. We also am aware that there's not a petrol arrival ship into the island until the end of next month. So all of that looks encouraging in the short term. But I guess now the challenge for the Economic and Strategy Committee that the Chief Minister is sharing, which is dealing with this Middle East conflict, that will come if that conflict gets extended and our supplies need renewing.
There are, though, I think...
That's different, I think, to the UK, where we have seen those spikes already and there has been allegedly a little bit of profiteering on behalf of energy firms. I was encouraged with what the Chief Minister said, and those talks have already taken place with the energy suppliers and the fuel suppliers on the Isle of Man, that they want everyone to be in this together and we work through it together. So that was encouraging.
And I suppose with your role in OFT, you will be more aware perhaps than most Tynwald members about what is happening in the marketplace.
Absolutely, and certainly the OFT, as I think the Chief Minister alluded to in the very first interview he did with Manx Radio on the situation in the Middle East, the OFT will play a very pivotal role in all of this. And I did notice on the way in this morning that for the first time in a long time that I can remember, the two petrol providers on the Isle of Man have got a slight difference in what they're charging at the moment. So that's probably down to what stores they have and what they're predicting for the future. But there was a penny difference between the two suppliers. Now, we've not seen that, I would probably suggest, for years.
There is, though, a significant proportion of properties on the Isle of Man heated by oil, yeah. And clearly oil is vulnerable. Now, gas is not as well. It's not affected to anywhere near the same extent as oil. Do you think that people who have oil tanks and maybe are looking to refill their oil tanks, do you think that the Isle of Man government is doing enough that they're going to be encouraged to say, oh yeah, we'll fill the tank up because we're going to be okay?
I do know quite a few people, constituents, have come to me and said they've ordered their oil when this news broke. So there is a genuine fear out there. But I think at the moment it is just a monitoring situation. We're reassured by the answers we got from the Manx Utilities chair in relation to another question. But also I think in what the Chief Minister said, but that is certainly something that the OFT, as consumer champions, will be keeping a very close eye on, and I'm hoping that the Chief Minister will be doing so as well. But he did allude to that, so I was relieved to hear that.
That was Tim Glover. MUA Chair John Wannenberg had some good news on fuel bills.
Talking to John Wannenberg, Chair of the Manx Utilities Authority, and you had some fairly positive news in relation to energy prices, certainly electricity prices, in answer to questions about the Iran war, certainly positive as far as the people in the Isle of Man are concerned, at least.
Yeah, well, it's you're quite right. Obviously, it's bad news internationally, but on our hedging strategy, we're doing quite well. Obviously, the prices have jumped from, I think it was 70 pence a therm up to over 120, and indeed it touched 170. But we are hedged up until the end of the financial year. We're hedged by 91%. And that's on the back of, you may recall, about 10 days ago, we did a tariff increase of a below inflation tariff increase of 1.5%. So we are looking strong in the short term, but no one knows how long this conflict's going to go on. And of course, if it does go on for longer, then wholesale price, gas prices will be going up, and the longer it will take for them to come down to previous levels. But for now, we are looking strong.
So in terms of the supply of gas, I mean that comes through the pipeline from Ireland. So why does a war several thousand miles away impact on these prices?
Well, very simply, it's supply and demand, isn't it? You know, when there's a war and where the gas comes from, then it's going to be in short supply. When everybody wants it, the price is going to go up. It's pretty much that simple.
And in terms then of the MUA, I guess this highlights the need for us to develop more sustainable supplies of energy into the future.
Well, never has it been more important to have our homegrown, consumable, renewable energy. I've been an advocate for that, and you know, this underlines the fact that we are vulnerable to these spikes, and that we need to take charge of our energy security as well as our food security. Both those things are vitally important for the future.
That was John Wannenberg. Chief Minister Alf Cannon answered the questions on the Iran war.
Obviously, that's some distance away from the Isle of Man, but the impact, particularly economic impact, is going to be faced by people here in the island.
That's absolutely right. They're serious questions. They're relevant questions. Absolutely from day one. Personally, there was a recognition that this may have consequences for the island, economic and potentially social consequences. We've stood up the Economic National Strategy Board to look very specifically at this issue. We had the first meeting last week. We will meet again tomorrow. At the moment, the plan is to carry on meeting weekly. We obviously need data. We need information. We can clearly see some impact now coming through in energy supplies in terms of the cost of that energy supply. We know at the moment the best information is the supply chains are all secure. There is plenty of oil and gas and the energy to provide the energies that we need. But of course, as we all know, the price of that supply is going to be impacted. We can see that supply price impact coming through at the pumps now. We're waiting to understand how that's going to impact on heating oil in terms of the price that will come through. But we are working with the fuel companies. And in looking at our electricity supply and the pricing that was quite significantly impacted during the Ukraine or the early months of the Ukraine conflict, we're more confident that we've got stability there. The Manx Utilities Authority are well hedged in terms of the forward purchasing that they have made for next year. So we are very clear that there's not going to be any immediate impacts in that particular area.
There will, though, have been people who have been impacted on this already. Your counterparts in the UK have announced schemes to support people, vulnerable people who are facing difficulty filling their oil tank, for example. I mean, the prices have increased quite considerably in relation to heating oil. We haven't heard anything yet from the Isle of Man government. Is this something that you are considering?
So, well aware that £53 million of support has been allocated. It's not quite clear how that's going to be accessed or to whom that's going to go. So we're monitoring that position just in terms of understanding how that support is being provided. I think for us, again, it is about being substantially clear on the real impact on the island. And at the moment, it is not entirely clear what price we are going to be receiving our fuels at. We're working very closely with our main suppliers to understand that pricing impact. And once we get clarity in terms of the price at which heating oil is being delivered, we will be in a better position to understand the impact on particularly the most vulnerable in society, but more broadly the impact on the community, and then make an assessment as to what, if any, support then is needed.
I suppose, though, people who are hearing on their news that this support is available in the UK, and you know we're not quite out of the sort of the cold months yet. People will be potentially wanting to fill their tanks up with heat and fuel, and not certain how they're going to afford to pay for it.
So I absolutely understand the concerns. You know, about we have something like 15,000 households in the island who use heating oil. The other 18,000 are on the gas network. So recognise that in substantial numbers of our households do rely on oil, and inevitably at some point are likely to want to top that up. You know, we have to assess you know, the price. Once I actually get the firm clarity on the price of the oil that is coming into the island, and the price that that's then being distributed at, will be in a better decision to understand what support is needed. Look, we've demonstrated during the Ukraine crisis we are well capable of getting support out and getting support out quickly and efficiently into the right areas. I need more data, more information, and we need clarity. The other thing that we don't understand at the moment, and of course didn't understand it in Ukraine, in those early days, was the sort of depth, breadth and scale of this conflict. You're getting lots of mixed reports that this, you know, we're going to see an end to cessation of hostilities within a few days, and then the next moment, you know, other commentators are suggesting this could go on for some considerable months. I think my reassurance to everybody is that we are doing our very best to assess the information that is coming through. We are in contact with the main suppliers. We are clear and secure that in our knowledge that the supply chain is working, there are no threats there, and that we were going to continue to monitor the price impacts and if necessary react to support the community and the broader economy if we need to do so.
And was it the Economy and National Strategy Board? That may be new to some people. I have to say I had to look it up, but and using the government system, I did actually find it and found out who's on it. But for those listening, who makes up that board?
So it is our main board in terms of looking at the overall sort of economic performance of the island, and also looks at key strategic issues that may be affecting the Isle of Man. I chair that board. I sit on it with the Treasury Minister, the Home Affairs Minister, who's also the Deputy Chief Minister, and also the Enterprise Minister. They're the four ministers that comprise the heart of that board, and the relevant officer support is provided from within those relevant key departments.
And then finally, we've just had the conclusion of the debate into an investigation by the Public Accounts Committee into government or Timbal Decisions government response report from 2 years ago, and you've subsequently had another report since then, and it's all starting to sound very confusing, and basically your suggestion is maybe we need to do this in a better way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are options for making this more streamlined. I think the one of the key points that was being made is that, you know, a Tynwald decision that took place 7 or 8 years ago may not be relevant for a new government. In fact, a new government may have a completely different view on that, and that, you know, we should have these mechanisms available to us for the new government to report on those decisions. I think also the way the report is structured, the amount of times that it's coming to Tim Ward, this sort of central management of it by the Public Accounts Committee could probably be done in a better way. We do have other Tim Ward committees. This is not about government not having scrutiny or not following through on the will of Tim Ward in terms of decisions that have been made. But we've had this debate so many times now that often a decision made 1 year is not that relevant 3, 4, 5 years later if it hasn't been taken through to completion by a particular government, and new administrations have different views. So look, this is about streamlining. I'm happy to accept the amendment that came from the committee that actually they will be best placed to decide how to streamline it. Fine, they'll go and have a look at it. They will come forward with new recommendations, or at least it seems a recommendation in terms of how things could be streamlined. We'll look at that when it comes through just before the end of this administration, I think, July.
One of the discussion points was surrounding Singer and Friedlander, which I remember from about 20 years ago. So, decisions from 20 years ago, are they still binding on, if Tim Ward's made a decision 20 years ago, should that not be binding on government until such time as Tim Ward changes its mind?
Well, look, I think sometimes these, for whatever reasons, there's been a decision made and government's either dealt with that vote in Tim Ward or it hasn't. And of course, the question is, do you carry on putting the onus on each new administration? I mean, in that particular case, you say something over 20 years ago, which had not really been a priority for successive governments, clearly, and the relevance for that, and indeed going back at some of these decisions that go after an incredibly long period of time, I think a lot of members would agree. Look, there are other ways for people to pick these things up. If they're important for the government of the day, then they're either going to be in the programme for government, or Tim Ward's been likely to be raising it again on the floor. So, some way to make this whole process more streamlined, more functional, more relevant is needed. And look, the position we're in is the committee have said, look, we'll take it back and we agree. We don't want to be over bureaucratic in assessing all these long-standing decisions and challenging government time out about where these have got to. So if there's a way to streamline it, they're going to come back with recommendations, and we will obviously assess that from a government perspective. The key thing is, that there is a relevance to today's government, a relevance to today's society, and I think we should be braver in terms of saying, look, something that happened 20 years ago and hasn't had completion or hasn't been followed through. The question has to be, how relevant is it? And what impact is it actually making on society? Because that's the most important thing.
Alf Cannon there. Next speaker, Watterson. The headline act in Tynwald this week, because you seem to have most of the substantive motions. But let's start off with questions. And you were asking questions, obviously, about the post office. What's your concern there?
Well, they lead into my motion for the changes that are coming forward at the end of this month about the post office network, and which of course the post office consistently say that this is a loss-making part of their network, and I and many others would say this is a service-providing part of their network. It's an essential part of life, and it's not about living in some wonderful state of the past, but I think government's been caught out with its sort of digital first, community last approach to delivery of services, and I think this needs exposing. And you can't just go and stop delivering services in a local community at the end of this month and hope that the hubs will be ready in a few months' time to help pick up the slack. I think it just shows a horrendous bit of bad planning on behalf of government and the post office, a lack of joined up government, and hopefully Tynwald members will have something to say on that later.
There is, though, a phrase, use it or lose it, and I guess one of the reasons why these services are being withdrawn from post offices is because very few people actually now need to use that service.
Well, actually, I wouldn't necessarily buy into that, given the numbers that were given to us this morning by the Treasury Minister. Hundreds of thousands of pounds a year going from government to the Allaman Post Office and then on to sub-post offices for delivering those services. So I don't think that really stands up at all.
Well, the post office network is clearly going to have to change in some way, because the general approach, I think, that for most people now is to do stuff online. Can you afford to have a post office network that survives purely to service a relatively small group of people, when effectively the post office staff will be seeing fewer and fewer of these applications or fewer and fewer of that sort of business, which then means that they have less experience and are less able to support customers?
I'm not trying to push water or pill, and the direction of travel is definitely increasingly digital online. The problem is that they withdraw the services from local areas where some people just aren't digitally enabled. There needs to be that support for those people to ensure that they can still pay their rates bill and do other things, whether it's online or otherwise. But they need to be able to do that in their local community. You and I, we can do that sat at home on the internet. That's not an option that's available to everyone. The post office, as at present, still provides that option for those people who need it, for those who find it difficult to get out and about, and they can do that in their local community. We've been promised hubs. They'll be coming down the line sometime, maybe, you know, there'll be a report in June. So when is that going to be implemented? And that's the real gap. That's the gap that I'm worried about, that people are going to fall into. And as a director of Southern Befrienders, I look at some of the clients there and worry about, you know, if the post office isn't seeing them come through the door, if the people at the Co-op or Tesco aren't seeing them come through the door, then how are you going to make sure that these people are okay? And there's someone just keeping an eye out for them and helping them deliver their the services to them.
And the infrastructure minister's comment that we will be doing something, but we probably won't be ready in time, is perhaps not as encouraging as you would hope.
Well, that's exactly my point. And so all I'm looking to try and do is, firstly, to get the post office to do what they promised they would do in 2019 when they brought along their change of strategy. And secondly, to get government to try and work out how to bridge this gap. And if that means doing this for a little bit longer whilst they wait for the hubs to come in, then that doesn't seem like an unreasonable thing to ask in the short term.
So then we move on to a few other items that have your name associated with them, one of which was a report produced by the Public Accounts Committee into a response to Timmel decisions by Council of Ministers, which has subsequently been superseded by a more recent response a year later. And Chief Minister amended, and his amendment was then amended by Mr. Hooper, to suggest that maybe there's a better way of doing all this.
That's right. You know, we're open to the idea there's a slightly more efficient way of doing this. The fundamental principle with this is that when Tindall has passed a resolution, made a decision, government's really responsible for implementing that decision. And if it's going to say that that implementation has happened or the decision's closed, then it's up to Tindall to decide that. And that's the principle that this is about, really. And that was what we saw today. And, you know, in fairness to government, of the 130 that were put forward as being closed or implemented, there was something like 123 of them actually between the committees and the government and the back and forth that were absolutely fine and were happy to accept. And it was only on the last sort of six or seven that that there was a bit of a fight, but actually it's worked out for the best. But it sort of goes to show that Tindall needs to be the ultimate arbiter as to whether its decisions have been implemented. And it's great to see that when members of Tindall go out to do seminars and things in the Commonwealth, one of the things that constantly comes up is, you know, we've recommended these things to government, but it just disappears into a black hole and there's no way of checking on it. We've got this wonderful thing called the Tindall Policy Decisions Report. It's a great check on the executive. It's held up around the place as a model of best practice. So it's something that does work, and it should maybe it could be done better, but it's something we should treasure.
The Chief Minister has suggested to this programme that actually decisions that were taken by Tindall 10, 15, 20 years ago should no longer be binding on government, because Tindall will have changed and government will have changed and circumstances will have changed. How would you respond to that?
Well, it's a very simple solution. Come back to Tindall and get them changed.
And I
how much simpler do you want, Phil?
Obviously it's not for me to tell the Chief Minister how he should do things. Well, in fact,
but I'm happy to do so.
So then one of the perhaps the more fun aspects of your role, is that you're moving a select committee report on which you have had very little input, but it's the Youth Select Committee.
I've had absolutely no input into it, and you can tell that because it's a great report, but put together by some fantastic young people who have picked up a topic that's close to their hearts. They've done a fantastic job on it. It's rigorous, it's well thought through, it's the lived experience that these young people have. It's a great example of the Tynwald as an institution ensuring that the youth voice is heard. If you give them a say, you give them a reason to stay. We're all about that in Tynwald, and this is a wonderful output that they've done, and look forward to the debate on it.
And obviously the Youth Select Committee won't get a chance to put forward their views. Presumably you've had briefings from them and had things prepared for you to read out.
Yes, I'm their humble spokesperson today, so I hope I do their work justice. But it is a fantastic report on housing and getting a foot on that housing ladder in the Isle of Man, as seen through the lens of actual young people living on the island. It's a great report. I think it'll get a good reception.
That was Russian MHK Ewan Watterson. Next, Chair of the Youth Select Committee during their housing consideration, Alex Cowley.
We've just witnessed your report being debated by Tynwald, and Tynwald backed unanimously the report.
Yeah, I was very glad to see that, and it's almost inspirational in a way to see that young people's voices are being heard, and that our collaborative work will actually make a difference, and that we will be able to influence policies that are important to all young people on the Isle of Man.
And what would you say was the overall thrust of the report? You know, what I mean, obviously you had, was it six recommendations altogether?
Yeah.
What was behind those recommendations? Because it was all about getting accessibility for young people in relation to housing. What was the evidence that pushed you in that direction?
So when we initially met as a committee, something that was a common interest to us all was housing, because it would impact us all eventually at some point. And then we went out into Douglas Town and spoke to young people similar age and saw what their opinions were. And then after that, we sent out a questionnaire as part of our call for evidence. And everything we gained back all pointed us in the same direction, that actually housing was a big issue and was very important to young people across the board.
And one of the problems that we have in the Isle of Man, of course, I mean, this was highlighted in the debate by Paul Crane, MLC, is we have this desperate need for a rebalance in terms of the economically active part of the population. The Isle of Man is growing older, so the things that you've recommended in your report will hopefully, if they actually are acted upon, make it a better place for people, young people to want to live and work.
Yeah, and you do highlight an issue of young people not wanting to return to the Isle of Man if they go away for university, or just staying here, even if they choose to work. I mean, it's really disheartening to go onto any housing websites, property sellers, and to see the price is completely out of any price range with an average salary, even if you have a higher salary. And then if you look to rent, you're not going to be able to save the money to buy in the future. And there was a real feeling that there wasn't much support from government in the first time buyer scheme. And we did highlight many areas where we thought that could be improved. And so hopefully, if this report is taken on board fully and policies are changed or schemes are updated and created to support it, then in the future, hopefully we will see more young people staying on the Isle of Man.
The Youth Select Committee continues. It wasn't just about one report. What's the latest area of work?
It's kind of following on from housing and more on the topic of trying to keep young people on the Isle of Man, seeing what are the main factors and why they do leave. And so we've decided the report would be on support for young people post-education, and so that includes work experience while they're in education, what opportunities there are if they decide to leave education at 16 or once they leave at 18.
I suppose I have to ask this question. One way that you could get yourself off the Youth Committee is by becoming a member of Tynwald. There's a Keys election coming up in September. How many of the Youth Select Committee are thinking about standing?
Currently, I don't think any of us are, but I think that's because we're all still studying. Whether some of us are doing our A-levels or me, I'm a student nurse at the minute, and I know some others are in law. So at the minute, we're just pursuing our chosen career paths, but I definitely wouldn't rule it out in the future, and I don't think any of the members would completely rule it out.
Well, certainly if you can get reports through unanimously in Tynwald, you must have some level of political skill.
And I think a big part of it is that all of us on the committee, and we work collaboratively, we all just come together with the same goal. And I think if you can have that open communication and have the same goal in mind, then anything really is achievable.
That was Alex Cowley of the Youth Select Committee. Julie Edge had an urgent question about bed availability in Manx Care.
Yes, it was in connection with the press release from the medical and the MSC, which is the doctors' organisation. I believe 75 doctors were party to that distribution of that letter of concerns. And it was raising concerns with regards to the safety element of the hospital, the lack of beds, and also staffing. So I felt it was important. The main issue for me, and I was following up really, was the bed capacity and how that's reduced since Manx Care. And you know, it's not something that they've not known about. Why have we reached crisis point that our doctors are speaking out for the safety of the patients and the public of the Isle of Man? And that's what it's all about, it's the public safety.
And were you convinced by the answers the minister gave? Because the minister, well, there seems to be significant discrepancy in what the doctors are saying and what Manx Care seems to be telling the minister.
And that was my challenge, really, that the public of the Isle of Man have lost complete confidence in the Manx Care Board, because we get so many different responses to data, and I'm beginning to wonder if they even know how many themselves. But certainly, up through a series of questions I've already been asking since 2024, the numbers have changed. I've had to challenge numbers, and then they change them again. And it does seem that there's nobody overall responsible for that patient bed flow management, which is what the doctors also talked about. And, you know, if somebody comes in through the door at Nobles and they may need a bed, somebody should know there's beds available or not, and what that, you know, what they do in those situations. My written answer was very clear, and of 8 months in the year of 2025, the hospital was not within safe bed limits, and I think that's significant.
And the other thing about this, I mean, that there are several government documents that Manx Radio is aware of, current government documents, each of which has a different figure for how many beds are available at the hospital. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard for someone to just go round and count these things, does it?
It doesn't. And, of course, I think since Manx Care, they've tried to conflate and add Ramsay's bed numbers into the Nobles' bed numbers so that it's an overall report. Well, actually, they need to be straightforward to the public. Nobles has got this amount, Ramsay's got that amount, these are operational and people are actually employed to work with them. But it doesn't add up to me when we're sitting in here and we're hearing the budget's gone up and the staffing numbers have gone up in the whole of the Isle of Man, and it's mainly because we had 500 new frontline workers in Manx Care. Again, I asked a question, it's back end of 2024 with regards to the additional 403 employees in Manx Care. And the answer I got back, Phil, was, well, we don't know where they're employed. We haven't been able to provide that information. That, again, is shocking. It's all data-driven and the reliability that the public expect for that funding. And if beds are reducing, why is the budget not reducing? Because you don't need so many staff if you've not got so many beds. So personally, having worked in Old Nobles, we had one bed manager and we had more beds than we've got now. Minister didn't answer that, hopefully she will, but if you haven't got a bed manager that knows how to manage the beds and work with the consultants for that flow through the hospital, we've got a real problem.
Is the minister being hung out to dry a little bit by Manx Care here? Because obviously government, the council ministers through the minister has delivered in terms of what was asked of them via the Jonathan Michaels review several years ago now. We are now up to the level of funding that was agreed needed to be provided to provide a good quality Manx healthcare service. So all the provision has been made, but you know, with these somewhat contradictory positions that are being fed through to the minister, I mean, is she being hung out to dry, do you think?
I find it incredible, and you know, there needs to be accountability from Manx Care Board, and that accountability needs to be challenged and questioned. And you know, if the minister hasn't been given accurate information, I would expect to see some action around that, because that, you know, Tim Walz, the highest court in the land, if we're not getting accurate information in here and the minister's being provided with it, we can't continue like that. And again, this is where, and I keep calling for a forensic audit. I've been doing that for a number of years. I think back since probably the first year of Manx Care. Unless you actually get somebody to go in and look at all of this, we'll never know, and all we'll do is keep spending more and more money. And I'm sorry, it's time somebody was held to account. The board was held to account. Apologies, not somebody. The board was held to account for the Manx public for safe access to healthcare, because they've paid virtually double for the healthcare since Manx Care, and they've seen the services decline, and we haven't even got a bed to put somebody in. Really concerned at the comments with regards to frailty and having a consultant to assess whether you're frail or not and whether you'll be admitted. That was shocking. You should be admitted if you need to be admitted. It shouldn't matter whether you're frail, age or anything. And that really shocked me to hear that today. So I will follow up on that. Because at the end of the day, if the person's frail, but, you know, what, are they sending them back out the door to die somewhere else? So it's not a statistic. I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to accept that. That was a significant concern. Raised my eyebrows. Hopefully, you know, I have heard it right, or if I haven't, I hope that'll be corrected. But I do want to see that framework.
You were also alluding, well, earlier in this interview, but certainly in the questioning, that perhaps the levels of supply of bed spaces in the hospital is in some way unsafe.
Well, clearly there's two. I know we've had the problem, and I really do understand we've had the problem with Ramsay having to close suddenly, but it's been closed a lot longer than expected. So where's the urgency for that? I think there's 20 beds or 25 beds at Morton Ward. However, 15 beds are occupied in Nobles because of that. So there's no forward strategic planning, I think, is my concern. And I've never seen that we do see it in areas of government, but never seen that in all my time working at Nobles Hospital. It was planned ahead, your replacement equipment, you knew your bed pressure. So when the hospital opened, and I think we said it was 314 beds, there was a clear plan there, and it said that hospital, when it opened, would cope with a population of 85,000. It even told you how much water would get utilised per year. Why has nobody in Manx Care looked at that report and said, well, we're missing here, we're missing that. What's gone wrong in between? Not all Manx Care, because they've only just taken over, but this is why it needs a complete look at. So Jonathan Michael's report, in my opinion, probably shouldn't have been followed to the record, because it was recommendations. We didn't have to take all them recommendations on board and cost the Manx taxpayer £200 million. Basic service and care is what we want. And the minister did open with this bed situation is not unique to the Isle of Man. We are different to the UK, and I'm a little bit fed up of hearing that coming out of Manx Care. We've always run a really effective, different health service that was supreme to the UK, and I don't want to see us going down the road of the UK. I think it's too late. I think we probably already have.
And prior to the creation of Manx Care, primarily the hospital, the health services were run by civil servants from the Isle of Man. Now, of course, Manx Care Board is primarily made up with experts, health experts from across the water. Do you think that's having an impact?
I think it's a huge impact, and I think it's the lack of understanding, and particularly politically, people can access their politicians. People know what services we've had, and all they've now seen is the system is deteriorating rapidly and continuing to do so. So the public are crying out for somebody to step in and say, what's going wrong? What are we going to do about it? And I think the board need to be You know, it's the minister that comes in here and has to speak up, not the chair of Manx Care Board. I do think I didn't vote for Manx Care to be set up in the way it was. It was wrong from the outset, so there are some elements in there. You know, I have sympathy with them. If you're not fully devolved everything to you, you can't manage it. Not an excuse anymore. We cannot hear it. Basic data on the number of beds you've got and whether they're occupied or not. But I think the doctor's concern as well was, it came across that they're under pressure to discharge people too soon, and then you're getting readmissions, which, you know, and I think that's a broken system, because you're sending somebody out, not well, there's another situation, they're coming in the process and they could be held for 12, 14 hours in A&E. They're not going to get better quickly. And it's significant, without a bed, without somebody coming in through A&E, being able to get a bed to go out successfully the other side, you know, back into their communities or that, it's significant. I know they've taken a ward out for chemotherapy and for doing an oncology suite, but that should have been planned. You were taking 20 beds out. Where were you going to find those 20 beds? You should have built an oncology suite somewhere else. That's what we would have done in the past. Again, lack of corporate knowledge and certainly not seeing it within the hospital setting of Manx Care. And to be honest, I'm concerned about other areas of Manx Care. There's significant challenges. And what would I do? I would actually make the significant change and say that politically there needs to be more accountability of Manx Care. And the way that the Act is written at the present time, that is difficult for the Minister to hold them to account. You can have a mandate, you can have an operational plan, but if they still overspend, nobody in government's allowed to overspend, yet we've seen it year on year. So there's something significantly not working in Manx Care, and I hope that the board can look to try and fix this. If not, we need to be looking at what we're going to do with that particular board and how the Isle of Man manages its health services.
The minister, the whole point of establishing Manx Care was so that politics could be taken out of the professional day-to-day operation of a healthcare service. And there's some sense to that, because ministers are not experts on brain surgery or whatever the issue of the day might be. But what's happening, it would appear anyway, that Manx Care are happy to allow the minister to take all the flak in Tynwald, and the minister's kind of, certainly in terms of our request for an interview, the minister said, well, we need to speak to Manx Care, even though it's the minister that's been answering the questions.
Yeah, the governance structure's all wrong, and it gives Manx Care the opportunity to state that. Do we need to take political out of the operational side of Manx Care? I think we've seen the answer to that. What's happened since that has happened? I think the public of the Isle of Man have not got the services they were used to prior, and we've seen the costs double virtually. That's the answer for that. Should it be a full statutory board operated like the post office, where there still is political accountability with a chair and a vice chair? I believe that would be the best way forward. Old hospital board that we used to have was a board separate from the DHSC, but that's how you can operate it effectively and successfully. And with only overspends of 10 million, look at the overspends and the increase. So, can the Isle of Man afford to continue with Manx Care operating the way it is? Probably not. Do we need to fix it? Yes, we do. Do politicians need to work to do that for the people of the Isle of Man? That's our job. That's our responsibility. It's not a devolved board's responsibility. And we need to get a grip of it quick.
Julie Edge there. John Wallenberg had some good news for commuters trying to get into Douglas from the south.
You also had a question in Tynwald about the works going on at the Whitehoe, which the Manx Utilities Authority have some responsibility for. Have you found a solution to the issue with regards to the significant problems that we've got with traffic coming in and out of Douglas from the south?
Well, Phil, yes, I think so. But first of all, what I would say is that there are significant problems with traffic, and I absolutely take that on board. But there are more significant problems with the underlying infrastructure, which had to be sorted out. And there's no way around that. You've got to do these things or else the roads will just disintegrate. So I'm pleased to say that actually the MUA has been working very hard, and I could have said this yesterday, but I wanted to be sure that we'll convert to one-way traffic at Whyto from tomorrow. And hopefully we'll go to two-way traffic on the 25th, I think it is. So yes, they've been working incredibly hard, and it's all to do with these large chambers above the 900-millimeter line that goes from Douglas up to Merriweg. And these are things you absolutely have to get right. And it involves curing of concrete, which takes time, and it doesn't need any vibration and the rest of it. But I don't want to labour the point. The important thing is that we've completed the works a little earlier than we thought we would. And hopefully, well, from tomorrow, there will be one-way traffic into Douglas.
So it's traffic travelling in from the south can go in that way. So I suppose that's going to be the busiest direction for the traffic.
That's absolutely right, yeah. So subject to the curing and routine safety checks, the road remains scheduled to be opening on the 25th, and indeed that one-way section from tomorrow morning.
And finally, Sarah Maltby succeeded in bringing Tynwald together to support getting a business case to Tynwald in May for finishing the horse tram track on the Prom.
You've been trotting along with a tremendous emotion about horse trams, and all the members have got on board.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It feels like I have dragged a few of them kicking and screaming. Probably would have been easier to stick them on the horse tram and do this motion there, really. But no, yeah, positive outcome. The original motion was to bring April's Tynwald. I recognise that was ambitious, but it really was to try and kickstart this conversation because despite what many people might think, this administration actually hasn't discussed the horse trams, and we have been waiting for this business case and waiting for the capital funding request. So this isn't something that we have actually had a say in. So it kickstarted that, and I think it was a really positive outcome, unanimously supported today, to bring it to May's Tynwald, which the Minister Crookall, did indicate was very possible. He would just need to work with his Treasury colleagues to ensure that that happened.
And that's quite surprising to me to learn that this iteration of Tynwald since the last Keys election, this hasn't been discussed.
Yeah, it does surprise me too, but I suppose there has been a huge amount of things that we have had to deal with and to get through. You know, it's not been an easy administration. I think many people from on the outside would recognise that there has been so many global challenges as well as trying to get our own house in order. So yeah, it's not been an easy administration, and these sort of things kind of drift along, and you kind of assume it's coming, we'll get that resolution, it'll be coming forward. We've been told that by ministers, so it's not as if it's been blindly being led down some sort of garden path there. We have been told it was coming, it just hasn't ever got to the bit. And Mr. Gard made a video. It sparked within me a passion to say, right, this has gone on long enough now. You really have had as many opportunities as we possibly could afford. We need to bring this into the public domain, because at the moment the public don't think that we care about this, and actually there's members in that court who really care about the heritage on the Isle of Man. And so this was to bring that to the fore, to say, if you're not going to do it, I'll do it.
And the really, I suppose, positive thing about all of this is that the minister was very positive in his contribution. Yes, he amended your motion to something a little less certain. That ultimately was amended to something a little bit more certain again. Effectively, though, the minister was saying, yeah, we're going to do this.
Yeah, he did. And obviously, I do want to really believe him. I'm a very optimistic person. You know, I don't think anybody sets out to not deliver the will of Tynwald. Sometimes it can feel that way, and I'm really concerned that if the May deadline is missed, what happens next? You know, this isn't a win yet. We haven't got that final decision. May is the new proposed date. That seems to be what the DOI believes that they can deliver to. We just really need Treasury to fully
embrace this. And like I said, when government wants to move fast, it most certainly can. And there is a process to go through. And I completely understand that. I was in Treasury for 2.5 years. But I also understand that Treasury meet weekly, and that if a meeting needs to be pulled together, then it most certainly can be. So there really isn't an excuse to say that haven't got time to deliberate this or to look into the finer details. They absolutely have. The COI Minister made a commitment on the 24th of February in the House of Keys that he was planning on bringing this to May. So between that date and May, that's a considerable number of weeks to have time to consider and to go through the business case that the DOI has got. So I really don't think there's any more time for excuses. And as I said, the end of the line for excuses is definitely approached.
That was Sarah Maltby. So what do you think? Are you a tram supporter? Do we need a post office network? Is government doing enough to address rising fuel costs resulting from the Iran war? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn. Thanks for listening.